From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on, we are going to be talking to Gerald Celente, looking through his eyes at the world. Here's what's happening. French investigators would not publicly identify one of the two people killed in a terror raid north of Paris early Wednesday, the other being a woman who detonated a suicide vest. But the Washington Post, citing two senior European intelligence officials, reported that the suspected mastermind of Friday's terror attacks was dead. That has not been confirmed yet. The man believed to be the architect of the massacre, a 27-year-old Belgian Islamic State militant, had mocked Western authorities for his ability to slip out of their sights into and out of Syria. Investigators traced him to an apartment just north of Paris. By tracking phone conversations and piecing together surveillance images and witness accounts, police confirmed that a woman in a suicide vest blew herself up during the raid, severely damaging the building's structural integrity. She apparently was the cousin of the mastermind. She was in her 20s. Jerry Corsi, of course, has been with us since the beginning of this tragic story. He writes for WND.com and is a noted author and researcher. Jerry, I wanted to get your updated views on where we are here. It seems like the French are doing an incredible job of raiding these various places around Paris.
You're right, George. I think the French are now finally penetrating some of the networks that the Syrian terrorists have used to get in and out of Brussels, into France, back to Syria. I mean, what we're finding is that the Syrian terrorist network is a very sophisticated and complicated structure using encrypted telecommunications and European Union passports to really move freely through the EU and back and forth into Syria and the Middle East.
They sure are. Now, we had some online threats towards New York today. Police are taking it pretty seriously. But on the other hand, the mayor is saying, hey, you know what, we're not going to be intimidated.
Well, George, a number of plots in the United States have been stopped. We don't know much in detail about the plots. But I think it's reasonable to assume that there are Syrian terrorists that are operating in the United States and trying to get into the country, especially through the border with Mexico. I think you're going to find increasingly in the next few days the reports are going to be coming out of apprehended terrorists trying to get into the United States through Mexico. We know for a fact, even with the bombers in the Boston Massacre, that many who from the Middle East who come here as refugees have, in fact, in the United States, transitioned to become terrorists. And we're just beginning to get a clue of the sophisticated nature of the communications that tie this radical Islamic, largely ISIS-affiliated group together internationally.
Jerry, the governor seemed to be at odds with the president, and a lot of people around the country now are beginning to wonder if the president has got a clue about what's going on around here. What's your take on all of this?
It is very unusual and very strange to try to explain why President Obama is taking such a cavalier attitude, agreeing with the United Nations that we have an obligation to relocate these Syrian and others coming out of the Middle East, mostly young men.
Yeah.
Not all from Syria. And even the head of the FBI admits we cannot really vet or determine who these so-called refugees are or what the future of their likelihood to become terrorists or not is. And that's very disturbing when the president is being undermined by his own intelligence chiefs, including the FBI.
Jerry, we'll be in touch with you, of course, on this story. In the days since this horrible terror attack in Paris took at least 130 innocent lives and wounded hundreds more, Americans have flooded into gun stores to purchase new guns and sign up for concealed carry permit classes in their respective states. And those buying guns include many who have never owned a gun before. John Lott, of course, author of More Guns, Less Crime. John, whenever there seems to be a crisis, there seems to be a push to sell and buy more guns. That's happening in this case, too. People want to defend themselves, I guess.
Right. Well, they're the last line of defense. I mean, look at what's happening in France right now. Their solution after the attack in January was to put 10,000 uniformed soldiers on the street. Over the weekend, the president of France announced another 1,500. What's not understood in France is that this huge strategic advantage is that terrorists have. If you put a couple armed soldiers in uniform in front of a building, the terrorists have multiple options. They can kill those individuals first. They can wait till those soldiers leave, or they can go and pick some other target that doesn't have soldiers in front of it. And what Israel has learned, for example, is that no matter how much money you spend on uniformed police and soldiers, if terrorists are patient long enough, they're going to find some opening, some set of victims that aren't being defended. In this city of well over 2 million people, 10,000 or even 100,000 soldiers may not be enough to go and protect all the possible targets that you have.
You know, John, I'm amazed at how quickly ISIS has put its act together in terms of money, munitions, weaponry. It's almost as if somebody else is helping them. I just get that feeling.
Well, I mean, obviously they've gotten billions of dollars from taking over banks and other assets in Iraq. They've had oil sales that they've had. You really only need a small number of people to go and cause a huge amount of trouble in a country. I mean, here we may have had, you know, 9 people or so directly involved in the attack in Paris. You may have had support people there too, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But in Germany, they found what appears to be a lone person involved in a bombing that was supposed to occur at a soccer stadium. You know, you're talking about small numbers of people. I mean, if you're talking about a couple hundred individuals that may be out there, they can do a tremendous amount of damage. And, you know, billions of dollars go a long way in adequately funding that size of group, a number of people that you're talking about.
Well, you're absolutely right, John, and that is our concern. A small handful of people can create all kinds of terror. At least 3 people have died. Hundreds of thousands were without power as a severe storm packing unbelievably high winds unleashed across the Northwest. Police said a woman in her 50s was killed when a tree toppled down on a power line. As it fell onto her, they could not resuscitate her. Then another woman died after another tree fell on her car near Spokane. Unbelievable weather out there. Former New England Patriots and Buffalo Bills quarterback Doug Flutie said both of his parents died in Florida within 1 hour of each other. The NFL veteran made the announcement via Facebook, writing that his father Dick and his mother Joan both suffered fatal heart attacks and died less than an hour apart. Flutie wrote, "They say you can die of a broken heart, and I believe it." Gains in Apple shares and healthcare stocks boosted Wall Street as investors awaited the release of minutes from the Federal Reserve's October meeting that were likely to underpin expectations of a interest rate hike next month. I don't think that's going to happen, but let's check in with the registered investment advisor, Michael Shedlock. Mish, what do you think? Interest rates going to go up soon?
Did you see the housing report today? Housing starts were down 11%.
I know it. That's
7
big.
7-month low. Last month, they were up 6.5%, but they revised last month lower. It seems like every time we get a positive report, the next report is negative, and sometimes we get a couple negatives in a row. At best, we're muddling through here. You know, if you can say that, you know, the Fed, you know, needs to do something and they kept interest rates too low too long, but, you know, maybe they should have hiked last year, you know, not now.
Not now. It won't work now. Mish, thanks, and you have yourself a great Thanksgiving, my friend. Hey, the creator of 2 of the most iconic pop culture images in the 20th century, Michael Gross, has died 70 years old. He's the artist and illustrator. He designed the Ghostbusters logo and then a dog with a gun to its head for the cover of National Lampoon's magazine. He was diagnosed with terminal cancer a year ago, and he died at his home in California. Up next, we're going to talk about the effects of electromagnetic fields on all of us, including children. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. For the next couple hours, we're going to give you some news you can use. Let me introduce, first of all, Katie Singer, a medical journalist and an educational consultant with the Electromagnetic Radiation Policy Institute, where she reports on the health and environmental effects of exposure of electromagnetic radiation emitted by cell phones, cell towers, and other common electronics. She was on with us about a month ago, but she's back with more information. Katie, welcome. How are you?
Hi, George. I'm glad to be here.
Great. And let me also introduce Dr. Victoria Duckley. She's one of the leading psychiatrists practicing integrative holistic psychiatry with children. She's prominent, award-winning voice for greater understanding of the effects of electronic screens, the environment, diet, and medication on behavior. And I'm looking forward to having you on the program, Victoria. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you, George. I appreciate you having me.
Katie, let us start with you, since you were last with us. You know, we're in an electronic age. We need it. You know, I've been the one saying we need to protect our grid from either an EMP attack or a solar flare from the sun, because without electricity, we are up a creek. But tell me about your concerns here.
Well, I'm, you know, since we're glad, I'm so glad to have Victoria Duckley on tonight. If we look at what's going on with the children around us, we are all seeing that they've got ADHD, they've got autism, they're depressed, they can be addicted to the electronics in, you know, that we're giving them. There are all kinds of problems that we're seeing. When I was growing up, I didn't see these kinds of problems, certainly not in the numbers that we're seeing now. And there are plenty of psychiatrists, as we know, who are passing out pharmaceuticals to children, and that isn't the way to go. But what's possible? That's the question. And I've been working with a pediatrician who has a protocol for reducing exposure to electromagnetic radiation. And she's seen a lot of results where that can really help families who are dealing with autism and ADHD. And then I learned about Dr. Dunkley's program, which is a little bit different. She's looking at screen time exposure. So it's just looking at the screen, which is different than looking into the eyes of another person or looking at a tree, looking at a plant that's growing. She's looking at screen time exposure, which is different from the exposure to radiation emitted by electronics. And I'm just really excited to hear more about her program and to tell about this other program for reducing your exposure to radiation.
And let's bring Victoria in. Doctor, tell us a little bit about your work in this field, if you would.
Yeah, so what happens is screen time, all screen devices act as a form of stress. So every time a child picks up that device and interacts with that screen device, their brains and body go through a state of fight or flight. And that happens not just by one mechanism, but by numerous mechanisms that I can get into in a little bit. But basically, when that happens repeatedly, the front part of the brain or the frontal lobe starts to shut down. So blood flow actually gets shunted from that part to the more primitive parts of the brain, and the child actually starts to behave in a more primitive fashion. So what we see is that all the things that the frontal lobe does become impaired. So mood regulation, so the child has meltdowns. Attention, so they have trouble focusing in school. Behavior, social skills, so they might not have as much compassion for other kids, or they're a sore loser. So all of their social skills become affected as well. And then because the screen light and the colors and intensity of the content and everything is so stimulating, their sleep is impacted. So, you know, particularly with kids, sleep impacts everything. So basically we're seeing all these different symptoms, and literally every kind of psychiatric disorder can be mimicked or exacerbated. So what's happening is we're seeing a lot of misdiagnosis, inappropriate use of medication, and misuse of resources, both for mental health and for education.
Now, this bombardment of what's happening electromagnetically, is it primarily coming from cell phones? Where's the crux of this?
Oh, is that for Katie or from
you?
Okay.
Thought I lost you for a moment.
Okay, I thought you were asking Katie. I'm sorry. So for the screen time, it's primarily interactive screen time. It's iPads, smartphones, texting, emailing, internet use, gaming. For the electromagnetic radiation component, you know, the electronics and some of the forms of radiation have been around for a long time, but the wireless forms have not been around as long, and that is the kind that has been multiplying exponentially, you know, in the last decade, and even in the last few years, it's been gone through the roof. And that is the kind that many of the researchers are most concerned about, because it has some of the same effects as other kinds of radiation, and it might have more potent effects as well.
Katie, let's come up with some tips on cell phone usage. I mean, since we last talked, you know, I'm trying to use the speaker portion of the phone rather than keep it up to my ear. I'm convinced that holding it up to your head could cause tumors. Sadly, I think my sister died of a brain tumor on the left side of her head, and I'm convinced there was a cell phone overusage that might have contributed to that. Text messaging is a little better than even being on the phone, but what other techniques and tips for us?
Sure. And I want to frame this because I do a lot of complaining about the FCC and their regulation of cell phones and, you know, how they determine that cell phones are safe and not safe. And what I've gotten to is, okay, especially if we're talking about children, what we want to do is teach children how to regulate themselves. If I keep complaining that the FCC isn't doing it, I've got to start doing it myself. And then when I am around children, I have something to offer them. The technique that I just learned about is to consider your cell phone a voice messaging device,
mm-hmm.
and turn it off, and then put it on the alarm. Put the alarm on so that you only get messages every 2 hours, say, and then you don't get zapped 24/7. You're only getting zapped when you're, you know, when it's on so you can check the messages. Otherwise, it's going to be in your pocket, you know, your breast pocket, your pants pocket, and it's going to say, did I get a message? Did I get a text message? Did I get a message? And every time it asks that question, which can be constantly or once a minute, once every 5 minutes, every time it asks that message, it's going to be connecting to the nearest cell tower, and, you know, you're right there for the electromagnetic radiation while it does that checking. So if you turn it off and get it to an alarm system, say, every 2 hours, so then you check for messages, and then you have a couple hours where you're not getting radiated.
But a lot of people aren't going to do that, are they?
Probably. That's true.
they have to have that phone. They have to have it with them. Are you primarily concerned about children? Why not adults?
Well, I'm concerned about everybody. But I'm, you know, as I see the children around me learning they're learning how to cope in this world with these devices. They're not learning how to make eye-to-eye contact. They're not learning as easily how to say, okay, this is too much for me, so that if somebody, you know, it's like what you just said, people aren't going to use this device as an alarm system. They're going to say, I've got to have this with me. And I think we all need to really look and say, what are healthy limits?
Okay, stay with us, Katie. We're going to come back, talk about those healthy limits, and also with you, doctor, in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We are, of course, going to have live programs for you on Thanksgiving night, okay, and on Christmas Eve night, and on Christmas Day at night, and then New Year's Eve and New Year's Day at night for you. You know what the routine is. If a holiday falls on a day I'm scheduled, I'll be live. If it's on a weekend, we let the weekend folks do it. If they can't, I'll do it too. But all live programs for you this holiday season. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We are with the medical journalist Katie Singer and also Dr. Victoria Dunkley. Their works in electronic silent spring and also reset your child's brain. Dr. Victoria, are you seeing in your practice children coming in who are truly affected by these electronics? Are they acting weird, strange? What are you seeing?
Well, virtually every child is. I mean, the first thing I do with every child I see is I try to do what I call the electronic fast. So I take them off all interactive screen time for a minimum of 3 weeks. And that is so we can not only resynchronize the body clock, reset the brain chemistry, lower their stress hormones, get them sleeping better, but it also tells me more what's going on. So it clarifies diagnosis. It allows other treatments to work better. And of course, as I mentioned earlier, we may even avoid the need for medication or at least minimize it.
Now that's an interesting take. Now, when you get them off for 3 weeks, is it difficult?
Yes. I mean, I sometimes, you know, some parents are ready to go right away. They understand what I'm saying, telling them, and then they're desperate and they're ready to go. Other parents, I work with them for months or even a year before I finally convince them to try it. But what I have found is that the more they really understand the science behind what's going on, not just what symptoms it creates, but why those symptoms are being created. And even with the people I see regularly, it takes a lot of time to explain those things, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book. But the better the understanding they have, and then when they see how those things translate into their child's symptoms, then they're more likely to act. Now, they also have to have enough support, and we also, you know, we have to think about ways for them to be able to do it so the child isn't sneaking, or, you know, we have to get the spouse on board, all those kind of things. But so it does take a lot of problem solving and support, but it is doable. And then when they finally do it, it's always easier than they think it's going to be.
I have seen some little children, 3 years old, with iPads, tablets, playing video games. They know how to turn the apparatus on. They know how to move the cursors around of the screen. I mean, it's absolutely incredible what they know about electronics. How do they know that so well? They know it better than most adults.
Yeah, I mean, they do. But I think, you know, children learn tech skills very easily. So even kids that have disabilities, or they have, you know, intellectual disabilities, or any kind of disability, they learn tech skills very easily. I mean, adults learn tech skills fairly easily as well, but kids learn them naturally easily. But that's, in a way, when we see them be, you know, such a whiz at these things, it can be dangerous, because we, you know, especially grandparents, sometimes they look at their child in amazement, or their grandchild, and that can be dangerous, because, you know, it looks amazing that they're doing these things, and sometimes we see two-year-olds doing things, or even one-year-olds doing things on an iPad that just seems miraculous, but really, it's, you know, we know that it's not good for them.
Does it freak you out when you see that? Let's say you're at a restaurant and you see a little one-year-old playing with an iPad and doing their thing.
I mean, I see it so much, I try just, you know, to ignore it. But when I hear about it, you know, when I hear either with my own patients or friends start telling me about their child's problems, or, you know, things like that, then when I see them also giving their child devices, yes, that really bothers me, because I'm trying to help them and explain to them that this is a source, you know, this is a large part of the problem.
Katie Singer, would you say that we are at an epidemic stage with this possibilities of electromagnetic radiation bombarding us?
Yes. Yeah, we're there. I mean, we're the electronics in our world operate at
frequencies and amplitudes that cannot be found in nature. And, you know, we've nearly saturated our environment with these frequency fields. And the human body is designed to function in concert with the Earth's electromagnetic fields. And with, you know, there are other sources of electromagnetic fields from nature, like from the solar wind and distant lightning, I mean, all these things. And we know how to navigate and balance and digest food and all of those things because of cues we take from nature. And now we're getting cues from man-made electronics. It's pretty overwhelming to the body.
Katie, have we gone too far? Have we created too many electronic gizmos in this lifespan?
Ooh, you're asking me such a question. I would say I'm doing what I can to make limits in my life, and that becomes increasingly hard. And what's exciting for me is that there are people who are talking like we're doing now about the question, okay, what can we do ourselves to limit ourselves? And so when you say you've put your phone on speaker more often, that's so fabulous. That's one technique. When I tell you, okay, what about using your phone as a voice messaging device? And you say, you know, I think most people, that's not going to work.
Right.
But we can get to a place of like, okay, let's negotiate. And then Dr. Dunkley's coming in saying, let's try a 3-week fast with the kids. I mean, the more that we can put things on the table and say, what can we do mm-hmm. to limit ourselves? That's where the juice is for me.
Gosh, I remember Victoria and Katie, when we didn't have cell phones and we didn't have those kinds of communication devices, and we got by. We got by. We did what we had to do. When we got back to the office, we had pink slips of messages of people to call. Life did not collapse, but you know, we got by. So what has driven us, and I'll ask you this, Doctor, what has driven us in this technological age to do this? Is it profit by the companies that has fueled this, or is it need by the consumer? What did it? Because again, many years ago, we didn't have this and we got by.
Right. And that's something I remind parents too, because they always are saying that their child needs a cell phone, because what if there's an emergency? And it wasn't that long ago that no kids had cell phones, you know, long after the adults had cell phones. And we still figured out how to pick them up from school and how to pick them up from the mall. And, you know, if there was an emergency, somebody had a phone or they could use a landline. That wasn't that long ago. So that's one thing, is just to help everyone remember how it used to be, and that we didn't need to answer or be beholden to our phones or our computers 24/7. And wouldn't it be nice if you didn't have to do that? I think it's driven both by the industry, and the industry making everything more and more convenient, and devices more and more convenient and accessible, as well as consumers trying to be competitive and always trying to be available.
I thought the television set disrupted the family. Mm-hmm. You know, people would, in the old days, you'd sit at dinner, you wouldn't have any outside influences, the TV wasn't on, and, you know, people communicated with each other. So I thought the TV had a lot to do with that. Now, whenever I go out, I see couples or younger people, older people too, you know, with their phones, having dinner, not even looking at each other, not even talking to each other, just sending text messages back and forth, or looking at Facebook or doing whatever they do.
Yeah, it's bizarre.
It really is.
Why are you meeting each other for dinner if you're not going to be talking?
I mean, I try to make it a point to put my phone away when I'm out. Mm-hmm. If I'm there by myself, a lot of times I'm using the phone for business and I'm emailing my staff and taking calls and stuff like that. That's different. But when you're out with somebody on that one-on-one, you really should put that phone away. You know, look at it when you go to the restroom or something like that.
Right. And I think, you know, sometimes people try to put their phones on the table and they try to just turn it over. But even there's studies that show even a phone on the table, even if it's off, is distracting. So we really have to put our phones, you know,
well that's right,
off the table, in the purse, you know, somewhere, or even leaving them at home is even better. And also just to have rules for the family, you know, certain, you know, that everybody puts their devices in a basket when they walk in the door, that there's no phones or any other devices during meal times. There's no devices in the bedroom. If you really stick to rules like that, you really can cut down quite a bit.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I'm convinced that fatal accidents in driving has increased dramatically since the cell phones.
Yes, and ER doctors talk about there's a huge increase in all sorts of accidents, both for children because parents aren't watching, and for adults because they're not watching when they're crossing the street, or they're getting in all sorts of accidents, walking into things, walking into poles, things like that, because they have their heads down.
Oh, yeah, I saw that happen once. Someone was texting, and they walked right into a streetlight pole.
Yeah.
I mean, that hurt. There was a well-known television plastic surgeon from Los Angeles, Beverly Hills. He was in his Jeep several years ago, driving around the hills of L.A., and he had his dog with him, answering text messages or sending them. He went over the edge. He died. The dog lived.
I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, unbelievable. So in terms of medical conditions, doctor, is it possible that it has contributed to more of an onset of Alzheimer's disease in folks?
Absolutely. There's evidence that it's contributing to Alzheimer's because people aren't using their brains to remember things, to remember phone numbers, to remember names, remember facts, anything, because you can Google anything, or it's stored in your phone. So people aren't depending on their brains to learn things or to learn directions, for example. People are just, you know, using their GPS for everything now. So they're not, and, you know, really maps is a really good way to exercise your brain.
Yeah.
Memorizing,
sure,
not just the map, but also where you're going.
Oh, so there's no doubt about it.
All sorts of evidence that between Alzheimer's and attention problems, we're just not exercising our brains as much.
So would you say primarily to a parent who's got a child of what age? What age should you really start being concerned with a child playing all these things?
Well, I mean, ideally, you know, one thing that all the executives in Silicon Valley, a lot of them have their kids in low-tech schools. So if you think about that, including like Steve Jobs didn't let his kids play with the iPad.
Huh.
So what does that tell you? But a lot of the execs have their kids in Waldorf schools, which don't introduce any technology until age 12 or sixth grade. Short of that, I've heard people recommend that one idea is to restrict any computer exposure, any tech exposure until basic reading, printing, and math skills are attained. And only then would you start introducing the other things. And I would add to that that even if you're sticking to that you would always pull back if the child is showing signs of dysregulation. So I just wanted to go back to what you asked earlier about what does that child look like when they come in and they've been affected by electronics. Mm-hmm. First of all, when kids have psychiatric issues, everything looks the same. So it's hard to tell things apart anyway. They're always, you know, crying and mad and having problems functioning. But basically, the children who are affected by electronics, they're dysregulated, which means they have trouble modulating their level of emotion. So they get mad and they can't calm down. They cry easily. They're stressed out. And then they can't focus. So they're struggling in school. They can't get their homework done. So anytime those problems are coming up, in addition to waiting until those reading, writing, and math are attained, that we should always be able to pull back if those things are going on.
Is it conceivable that the bombardment of all these electromagnetic waves is contributing to this even beyond holding on to a cell phone or a tablet?
Yes. So when I first started to write this book, which I started writing it about 5 years ago, I didn't even know what electromagnetic radiation was. And I just kind of started learning as I was writing the book, and I started looking at all the research. And what I found was that many of the things that I was seeing, that the screen time research showed, that was also what I was observing, matched what the radiation research showed in terms of causing that high levels of arousal, causing melatonin suppression, and causing addiction, you know, possibly exacerbating those addiction pathways. I think the screen time, the body of research for screen time is a lot more robust, and there's not as much controversy surrounding it.
Right.
But there's a lot of things that are similar, and so what's probably happening is there's a lot of synergistic effects that, you know, and there may be varying degrees in different children about how much they're impacted by the different components, but obviously if you reduce both of those things, you're going to have a much happier, healthier child.
So you're sitting on a plane, and the plane has Wi-Fi. Does that affect us too?
I mean, planes have a huge amount of radiation to begin with, even before they had Wi-Fi. So, yeah, I think everyone's devices, everyone around you has devices, and it's bouncing around a metal airplane. Yeah, I think it's probably a crazy amount of radiation.
Not good at all.
Yeah.
Katie, tell us about the Institute, of course, the Electromagnetic Radiation Policy Institute. What do they try to do?
We've been trying to work with federal agencies to get safer regulation. And I can't say we've been very successful. We're still working. One of the things that I would love to see now would be warning signs. So, for example...
Like cigarettes, right?
Exactly. Like cigarettes, like in cars... There are, I think there are some cars now that have signs that say, hey, there's an airbag here, so a child shouldn't sit
right.
in this seat.
Yep.
And if we could get warning signs that as you approach a router, say, or some other area where there are high levels of electromagnetic fields, you'd have a warning, and you wouldn't want to get a child there. I also just want to jump in and say one of the simple techniques that people can experiment with is turning the Wi-Fi off at night for at least 12 hours while you sleep. You don't need the Wi-Fi while you're sleeping.
That's a good point. Katie, stay with us, and you, Dr. Victoria Dunkley, as we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We're going to open up the phone lines now, so folks, if you have questions or even stories that you might want to share with us, we're all ears right here on Coast to Coast AM. You can email me as well at george@coasttocoastam.com.